This is the Monday, November 9th, 2015 episode of the History Author Show. Visit our iHeartRadio channel or subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a brand new episode every Monday morning.
Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize, sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Carianis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and many other personal audio outlets. You can also tune us in on many new model car stereos, where you can listen to iHeartRadio just like any other radio. Of course, today we're not driving a car, but a time machine. Our destination is the battlefields of the Great War. Just in time for Veterans Day, Remembrance Day. The Great War is when the Industrial Revolution applied its innovations of mass production to the work of mass slaughter. Whereas there are many positive impacts of the Industrial Revolution, poison gas, chemical weapons, tanks, and barbed wire were not among them. The suffering of the soldiers on all sides still moves us today. As we live the 100th anniversary of this dark period, we decided to hear from the people who fought and lived through the war. Not just on the Western Front, but from Mesopotamia, Gallipoli, Italy, and Northern Russia. We'll do that with today's guests, Bristol writer and former journalist Jacqueline Wadsworth. Her book is called Letters from the Trenches, The First World War by Those Who Were There. In it, she reveals how the war touched everyone, from officers and conscripts on the front line, to women and conscientious objectors at home, to the maimed and injured who would carry the scars of the fighting for the rest of their lives, and also the Germans who endured mass starvation. Letters to and from loved ones back home were crucial to your morale if you were in one of those trenches. Sergeant John Adams, 9th Royal Irish Fusiliers, wrote in May 1917, quote, "For the day we got our letter from home is a red letter day in the history of the soldier out here. It is the only way we can hear what is going on, the slender thread between us and the homeland." To tug on more of those threads, visit soldierletters.blogspot.com. That's soldier, singular. And follow Jacqueline Wadsworth on Twitter at Soldiers Letters. Notice that one's plural, Soldiers Letters. But first, let's hear from those voices way before Twitter, Facebook, and websites. Let's hear some letters from the trenches. I'm joined on the line by Jacqueline Wadsworth from a small town near Bristol in the southwest of England. She's author of Letters from the Trenches, The First World War by Those Who Were There. Thank you for making the time to talk with the History Author Show.
Well, it's my pleasure, Dean.
I really was excited about doing this book, especially on Remembrance Day, Veterans Day, Armistice Day. The 11th month, the 11th day, the 11th hour is when, of course, the armistice ended World War I. We will start with the inspiration for Letters from the Trenches. Tell us the story of your great uncle, Fred Wood.
Well, Fred Wood was my grandfather's younger brother, and he was a character I knew very little about until I started looking into my own family history. And then slowly he started coming into focus. He and my grandfather grew up in a working class family in Bristol in the southwest of England. They were both sociable. They loved football, which I think is your soccer. And when war broke out, they lost no time in volunteering for the army. Fred was 17 years old. He was actually legally too young to join the army, but the recruiting officer waved him through, as they did so many young soldiers during the war. And within a few months, after a bit of basic training, both brothers found themselves on the Western Front in France. And they kept in touch with each other by writing chatty letters, a couple of which still exist, and they're very endearing. You could hardly guess a war was going on, actually. Fred wrote to his brother about football and about friends that they both knew on the front. For example, he said, "I hope you're doing well off half back, and I hope you keep it up. That's a reference to football, which was played a huge amount behind the trenches in the rest area. How is Jim going? I expect Jack Glover was surprised to get my letter. This was the sort of letters they wrote to each other. Leading up to the Battle of the Somme, which was launched in July 1916, things became a little bit more tense. The brothers kept in touch just by postcards. And then Fred was one of the first to go over the top on the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And he and his platoon marched over open country. They were told, don't charge. British had been bombarding German lines for the week before. They thought there'd be no resistance left. But of course, this turned out to be completely untrue. Fred never returned. He was missing, presumed dead. His story ends with his final letters and cards to Edwin, and the story's taken up by his brother Edwin in a little diary he kept at the front, saying, no news of Fred, no news of Fred. And he started spreading the word among his friends at the front, asking if anyone knew what had happened to his brother. And after a couple of weeks, he got a friend of a friend, wrote a little couple of lines that said rather poignantly, Fred Wood's platoon touched out bad, a shell pitching in the centre of them while they were attacking. Of course, there's every chance of him being in hospital. Well, I hope he is. But in effect, Fred was probably blown to smithereens. One of 20,000 men, British men, on that first day of the Battle of the Somme, who didn't survive. He was never found, his body was never found, but his name is remembered on the magnificent Thiepval Memorial in Picardy. And a couple of years ago, when I discovered this, my own family, we went out there to pay our respects to Fred where he fell. And I think that was probably the first time any family member had been out to see where he died, because of course he came from a working class background and a trip to France would have been out of the question until our generation, really. And that's the story of Fred.
You say 20,000 on the first day, just on the British side. So I wanted to pause on that for a minute. The numbers get to be so staggering, especially with that first battle. And of course, when you deal with those huge numbers, when you focus on just one soldier and get to know him through his letters, as you do throughout letters from the trenches, it really does bring it home and you get to relate to them and know them. You made such an impression when you shared your great uncle's story that Pen and Sword publisher commissioned this book, Letters from the Trenches. And so then you were faced with, I think, a challenge a lot of writers can relate to. Where do I get my content? So how did you go about assembling these letters?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. I was commissioned to write the book. I was very excited. And then my next thought was, where on earth am I going to find this material? I was asked to write the book in 2012, which was before the First World War centenary really got going. Obviously, it sort of came into being in 1914. I'd assumed there would be quite a lot of material in archives, museums, libraries. But I thought just before I visit these places, I'm going to see what's in the homes of ordinary people like me. So I sent letters appealing for material to the local paper, a couple of family history magazines, nostalgia magazines, got in touch with a couple of family history groups, and was absolutely staggered by the response I got. Not just a letter here and a postcard there, but sometimes whole volumes of letters written by one soldier throughout the war, photograph albums, and of course, as well as this material, the stories and the memories to go with them. And in the end, this is what the book was based on, with a few choice letters that I got from the Imperial War Museum and the Bristol Record Office. But it was mainly just ordinary families like yours and like mine saying, here's what I have. I don't want my ancestor forgotten.
And you mentioned that they didn't just send letters either. They include pictures. They include, I think, a lot of things that really surprised you. And I bet you tore them open and it was exciting to get those items. And then probably a little step back where you say, these are people that you know that they had their tragic end. You see their smiling faces in that moment that the flash goes off. And then probably a third feeling where you say, I can memorialize them, as you said, and do something for them. So how did you go through the editing process? How did you decide which faces to include in the book? And do you have some that are favorites and some that you maybe got to you after you published? How did the whole process go?
Well, you're absolutely right. I had hundreds of photographs to choose from in the end. And in fact, one of the most difficult parts of writing the book wasn't writing it. It was choosing which photographs to use. In the end, I just tried to vary them. And I made sure that if there were characters that ran through the book, and there are characters, I included those people. When you say sometimes you look at photographs and become sad because you know what happened to them, there are faces like that. There's a 15-year-old lad called Charlie Butler, who enlisted obviously when he was 15, and another boy called Ernest Adams. He was 19, but they both had angelic faces. Ernest looked 12 if he looked a year. Charles looked no more than his 15, and they both died in action. There are other photographs that are favourites for other reasons. There's a very dramatic picture that was taken by a young naval officer, actually just after the armistice in 1919, when the war was still going on in northern Russia against the Bolsheviks. And he took a very good picture with his own camera of Bolshevik prisoners who'd been rounded up on the banks of the Dvina River and held in what he calls a bolo cage. It's just very dramatic to look at. Perhaps, personally speaking, one of my favourite photographs is a family one taken in 1914. A soldier called William Cole was off to war, and in his final day he had a photograph taken with his wife and his young children. And among his young children was 4-year-old Sid. And 100 years later, I spoke to Sid when he was 104 years old. It was amazing. His memory was still crystal clear. He remembered that day. He and his mother and his young sisters had been taken up on the train to the east of England, where they met their father, who was about to go off to the front. And he remembers the porter coming to help his mother with the luggage to get it off the train. And he remembered going to the boarding house where they stayed. His father did survive. He sent the children back some lovely embroidered postcards, one of which I've included in the book. And he remembers he and his sisters sticking them on the wall of their little tiny bedroom that they all shared. But all our First World War veterans are obviously dead now. And Sid, who sadly died between the book being published and now, he was the next best thing, I suppose, someone who actually remembered someone going to war.
How amazing that he remembered it. I was getting a little bit nervous as you told the story, if that's the right word, or feeling the drama of it, wondering if his father made it. Maybe he remembered because those were the last moments with his father, which of course many of these children would have had that weren't as fortunate to have their soldier come back and come back in one piece, come back not broken mentally or physically, really damaged. There was, of course, poison gas. There was chemical attacks. There were so many things like that in the Great War. So to have somebody who had that connection, that must have really fueled you to be able to continue and made it so much more real.
Well, that's it. Because there are still people, my mother among them, and my father, they obviously can talk about their fathers who went to the war, but they weren't born when they were fighting in the war. And Sid Cole's dad, as you say, was actually in the war fighting. And I'm very glad, too, to be able to say that actually the father came back. Actually, Sid didn't tell such a romantic story. He said his father was very strict when he got back. He was a shoemaker, so it wasn't a sort of happy ever after. It was a more realistic tale that he told. But at least the father came back. If I might say, it was nice because I do have another child's recollection of the last time she said goodbye to her father, and actually it was the last time she ever saw him. Her name was Evelyn Luxton. She and her sister, she was under 10, as was her sister, and they lived with their parents in South Wales. And her father, Philip Luxton, went off to war in 1915. And she wrote down later in life the last time she remembered seeing him. She lived in a little mining valley. I remember his last night at home, a cold, wet, wintry night in the middle room lit by a poor gaslight. He was dressed in uniform. He did not want us to go to the station with him and kissed us all goodbye. As soon as he left, Mother told us to get our coats, and we followed him, unseen, to the station. It was cold, and the rain was beating down. There were hundreds of people there saying goodbye, and the station was lit by gas lights. And she said, looking down from a bridge, Evelyn watched one distressed young woman fall to her knees and hold on tight to her husband's left as he climbed up onto the train. And she said then she saw her father board the train, and this was the last time she would ever see him. So there are very, very sad stories, as well as the happier ones Sid told.
It's something I guess we're all guilty of, and I guess I was a little guilty of there myself, which is casting it as this romantic great adventure, which is interesting because, of course, people kind of thought that going into the war, that it would be romantic. They had sort of a naive, I guess you'd say, view of the war and how fast it would be over. One of the questions you received in another interview was about Christmas, and you talked about people on the home front, which you talk about throughout Letters from the Trenches, sending gifts to the soldiers at the front. And one of the interviewers asked you, what did the soldiers send back? And you politely explained it's not as if there were a lot of gift shops there in the trenches. And I thought sometimes they would get letters or postcards, as you mentioned, but it's really hard to imagine because we are used to such a different view of war. And to go to the primary sources here, when your book opens, right, a time when Britain has been at peace for 100 years. So explain to us just how your book opens and how you progress through these ages of the war, especially after the Battle of the Somme there, when it's really this sobering moment where you realize it won't all be over in a few minutes, thanks to technology, but much different, actually extended because of technology.
Yes, well, when you say you felt a bit guilty describing it as a sort of a bit of a romantic notion, you shouldn't, because a lot of people, when war was declared, did have a great deal of excitement. In Britain here, the economy was in the doldrums. People didn't earn huge amounts of money, by and large, unless you were in the aristocracy. Life could be dull, and when war was declared, it was a cause of excitement for many. Of course, we had no idea what it would involve, because, as you said, this country, Britain, had been at peace with its European neighbours for 100 years. There had been conflicts, but that was in the colonies, hundreds and thousands of miles away. And of course, the British Navy and the Army took care of all that. It wasn't something ordinary people could get involved in. But this war was something they could get involved in. They were required to, really, because the British Army was very small at the turn of the century and volunteers were needed to boost the numbers. In describing what it was like in this country when war was declared, I came to Bristol, which is near where I live, where some of my family grew up, and it was a typical provincial British town. So I thought it would serve well to describe what was going on all over Britain. And I used the letters of a woman called Maud Boucher, who was a mother of four, an intelligent woman who lived in Bristol, and throughout the war she kept a scrapbook stroke journal in which she stuck newspaper cuttings and then added her own notes to give a personal touch to the description of war. The day before war, no one still knew quite what was going to happen. Most people thought, well, if there's going to be a conflict, it will be in Ireland, because there the Home Rule question had begun raising its head. But this is what Maud Boucher wrote on the 3rd of August 1914, literally hours before war was declared, and still nothing was quite certain. She said, "There was a great talk and feeling on that day that we might go to war ourselves, and one kept hearing people say, 'If we have a war, etc.'" The day before war was declared, Maud Boucher wrote this in her journal, and it just shows that no one still had any idea what was about to happen. "There was a great talk and feeling on that day that we might go to war ourselves, and one that kept hearing people say, 'If we have a war, etc.' I said to Stella," Stella was Maud's friend, "'You don't really think we shall have a war, do you?' And she said, 'From what the papers say this morning, it looks as if there's every likelihood of doing so.' and the next day war was declared. And there was a great deal of excitement, not fear at that moment, not depression, but excitement about what was to come, because the word was it would all be over by Christmas anyway. And this is what Maud wrote in her journal. The excitement was tremendous. Mobilisation all over the country was taking place, and suddenly there seemed to be hundreds of soldiers everywhere. Motor lorries of all descriptions in strings of nearly 50 or more, one after the other, either filled with soldiers and baggage or else quite empty, they went racing up White Ladies Road by night and day on the way to the docks at Avonmouth, and Bristol was quite a transformed city. On the walls of the artillery grounds were soldiers sitting day after day, ready with their kit to go to the front or to different parts of England to guard the coast and to do extra drilling and training when their orders came. So that was the scene when war was declared.
It occurred to me that you mentioned the excitement there, and also then about people being from this working class background, not having a lot of money, and specifically that traveling to somewhere like France or Belgium would have been impossible. And that had to be part of the draw. We still hear that today in a different sense, where you'll say, join the Navy, see the world, join the Army, go to exotic places. And of course, there's bases all over the world, and there's territories all over the world still for the British Empire. And so they would have thought, this is maybe my one chance to get out of my little town near Bristol and go and serve the country. And of course, you'd want to be proud and wear the uniform and have excitement. It's sort of watching a slow motion car crash a little when you watch, when you're reading these letters and letters from the trenches, because we know what's coming. And it's easy, I think, for me anyway, you get a little bit angry reading it, and you get a little bit frustrated with the people sometimes, and sad. Even something like this father going to the train station, not wanting his family to come with him. You wish you could step into the letter and tell him how important that moment will be, and not to make your children kind of come there like thieves. I'm sure he had his reasons, but it's easy to apply all of that. And then I remind myself that they didn't know all these horrors were coming, of course. We only know it because we live 100 years later. So I think of David McCullough. David McCullough says, the people living back then didn't know they were living back then. So people in 100 years will look back at us and say, well, they were living back then. They did all these strange things. How did they not know? Well, for us, it's just the present. And in Letters from the Trenches, you address that. You talk about how these people just lived their daily lives. They didn't go into this war with their head down. They were just starting this off with their everyday lives and doing their duty with no idea of the horrors to come. And they still had things that were funny to them. They still had humor and moments back home. And you share some of those uplifting moments and funny moments, some black humor too, in Letters from the Trenches. So share some of those with us.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And when you say the war seemed like an adventure abroad, that's exactly how people like Fred and Edwin Wood, my great uncle and my grandfather, saw it. It would have been their only chance to go abroad. And don't forget also, there were still a lot of slums in Britain. And for some, an army would mean a decent uniform, decent food, somewhere decent to lay your head. And it was an offer they certainly couldn't turn down. But there were funny and uplifting moments. I think, I'm sure it's true of a lot of countries, but certainly the British do like their ironic humour. And that helped a lot of men get through. My grandfather told my cousin, not me, he never spoke about the war to me, but apparently he told my cousin that in the trenches, every morning when they were in a certain area, they had to walk through this trench to go and get their breakfast. And there was a corpse's grey arm sticking through the trench wall. And every morning, him and his friends, they would all walk past it, shake its hand and said, "All right then, mate." And this is a sort of gallows humour, I think, that was appreciated by a lot of soldiers. And let's face it, I mean, it's the only sort of humour, you know, that was around for a lot of them. There were some letters that made me smile. There was one by an 18-year-old recruit called Private Cecil Cadmore. And he joined the army in 1915 as a volunteer. And he did a few months of training in Britain. And at this time, The army was full of volunteers, including the officers. And to say it was a case of the blind leading the blind, I think was quite truthful in a lot of occasions. Certainly in the training day that he describes in a delightful letter to his cousin Gwen. This is what he wrote. He said, "It's obvious that the officers don't know what they're doing any more than the men. Last Tuesday we were doing wood fighting. Before we started, we were told not to pick blackberries while advancing. We went through one wood in fine style and across and into another wood. We surprised about 60 of the enemy and captured them, and then got cussed for leaving the first wood. Then a major came up and said he would lead us through the next wood. He pulled out a compass and said we would march by that. Then we gave ourselves up for lost. We always do get lost when marching by compass. Well, we did get lost, and I picked a lot of nuts while we were halted, which we were every minute while the major consulted his compass. When we did get out of the wood, we found the rest of the battalion had finished the attack and grub as well. Never mind, I ate nuts all the way home." And it was this rather light-hearted humour that he used that must really have delighted his cousin when she received that letter. And it's perhaps that was the reason she kept it, because a couple of months later, you know what I'm going to say, he was out at the front and he was killed in action as well. But a lovely memory for Gwen, his cousin, to have.
My guest on the line from the UK is Jacqueline Wadsworth, author of Letters from the Trenches, The First World War by Those Who Were There. You can see some of the great pictures that we mentioned, the diaries, the letters, all from the people who wrote them. These are available at her website, soldierletters.blogspot.com. Note that's soldier singular, no S on there. And you can follow Jacqueline Wadsworth on Twitter at soldiersletters. There's the S there, soldiersletters. Discover your history magazine called Letters from the Trenches, a warm evocation of how ordinary people's lives were affected by a devastating conflict, and they highly recommended it. I thought, Jacqueline, that warm isn't a word you'd associate with war stories, much less these cold, deep trenches. You mentioned Sid's father being a shoemaker, and I thought that must have been a particularly frustrating thing down in those trenches because, of course, we hear about trench foot and we know that their feet were often wet and rarely dry, soaked socks, all of this kind of thing. But people felt all these emotions, humor, love, just as much as they do now. You have quite a few love letters here in the book, correspondence between sweethearts that you included. So share a few of those with us.
Oh, yes. There are some very moving, very touching love letters between sweethearts, between married couples. And one of the most moving was written by Philip Luxton. This was the father who said to his daughters, "No, don't come with me to the station." He wrote assiduously back to his family. You can tell he missed his children dreadfully. On August bank holiday, the first August he was out in France, he wrote to his wife Hannah, "I expect you will soon be preparing for to take the children down to the sands, and I hope you and the kiddies will enjoy yourselves, and don't forget to buy them a bucket and spade, just as if I was with them." You get the impression the reason he didn't want his children to come to the station was because it might have broken him. A few days later, he wrote this to his wife, "Because I am away from you, my love is not getting colder. For you are on my mind both night and day, and when I returns to you, I hope I will prove it, because no man loves his wife and children better than I do. It will soon be 13 years since we was married, and I am sure we have never regretted it, and I hope and trust that we will have another 13 years as happy as the last. I wish I was at home to have one real kiss with my old Dutch, from one that loves you from the bottom of my heart." And sadly, very sadly, we know that was never to happen. There are some lovely love stories in the book, actually. One Canadian couple who were sort of circling each other before the war began, neither confident enough to show their emotions to the other. Once war broke out and the man went to war, they had nothing to lose, and they wrote letters. They courted each other by correspondence, and they ended up getting married during the war. Not all ended happily like that one. There was a couple, a very handsome couple. You can see the picture of them in the book. Ern and Beatty West, they were called. They weren't married when Ern went to war, but after corresponding with lovely postcards and letters throughout the conflict, Ern finally came back on leave a month before the armistice was signed in 1918, and the pair of them got married. They went off on honeymoon for 2 weeks, and then he was due to go back to the front, but he didn't. He had to return to the church where he got married. This time, though, when he walked up the aisle, it wasn't with Beatty on his arm. It was next to her coffin, because while on honeymoon, she had succumbed to and died of the Spanish flu, that awful scourge that followed men back home during demobilisation and just a bit before then as well, and actually killed more than the war did itself.
The flu is just another one of those things that we know is coming, and I think it can make it hard to look back at this period. That's why reading Letters from the Trenches, I enjoyed seeing the human side of people. This is our responsibility to remember them for what they went through, and also because we know that really there's nothing conclusive out of this war. We say Armistice Day, November 11th. It's not a day when there's a clear victory, and we know it not only doesn't solve the issues of the war, but it only lays the groundwork for the Second World War and all this suffering in between with the flu and with the worldwide depression. And a lot of this really was important for them to control if you were in power, because you had things like the Bolshevik Revolution, of course, that takes Russia out of the war. You had rebellions in the French ranks. And so there was a big role of censors in writing these letters. Somebody would read these letters before you were able to send them home. So did you notice people writing around the censorship as you were reading them?
Yes, to a certain extent. I noticed more, especially at the beginning of the war, place names crossed out or a few sentences crossed out. It was the officers at the battlefront who were the ones who censored their men's letters. And they weren't allowed anything to go through that could reveal troop positions or battle plans. So that's what they had to do, just make sure all these letters didn't give anything away. I think troops understood fairly well what they could and couldn't write. I think that's one reason why letters weren't absolutely obliterated by black marks. But I did get the impression as the war progressed, there was less censorship. Very possibly because the officers on the battlefronts had so much to do, as well as also going through the men's letters, this just became another job that perhaps wasn't done as well. Some officers didn't like reading their men's letters. Lord Reith, who actually later became founder of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, he didn't censor his men's letters. He just put them on trust and said, you know what you can and can't write. I will trust you to do what you should. But as I say, as the war wore on, more details started coming out, possibly because it was hard to keep things secret. If men going home wounded and on leave, and newspaper reporters filing stories back home, people knew roughly what was going on. But it was quite surprising sometimes to see big assaults heralded in men's letters. I was surprised to see this. And I'll give you an example. In 1916, before the Battle of the Somme was launched in July, a couple of soldiers of letters that I read, and there must have been many more like them, were warning family at home that something big was about to happen. Private Stanley Goodhead wrote to his father this, and remember, he shouldn't really have been given any idea that there was a huge great campaign about to kick off. He wrote, "Very soon now, I, along with many others, will be going into very great danger, and I am taking this opportunity of letting you know so that you will not be surprised at whatever may happen. You will understand, Dad, that I am not allowed to say too much, so I must leave it to you to read between the lines and use your own discretion as to how you tell them at home. We are all in splendid condition and in good spirits, and to see the lads, you would hardly believe there was a cloud hanging over them. We are at present getting plenty of food and good rest, and our hard training is at an end for the present. Everything is being done to make things a success, and nothing is being left to chance, and I am confident that good results will be obtained. I wish to thank you, Dad, for the way you have looked after me whilst out here, also when at home, and you have my very best wishes. If this should be my last letter, you will find everything in order. And another sergeant was writing at the same time to his sister, "We are going to have a big dust-up, so this is to tell you to look out for things and to hope for the best. I have nothing to tell you, but will drop another line as soon as poss to let you know all's well. I have very little time, and so will ask you to let the rest of our little family know what I have written. Goodbye just now, and may God look after you all." I'm pleased to tell you, Dean, that both these men survived not only the Battle of the Somme, but the war as well.
Incredible. You wouldn't, as you said, you get the drama really reading these letters because you get to know them so swiftly. They're all so well written and emotional that you really do find yourself rooting for them even 100 years later to come home safe.
Absolutely.
My wife's grandfather, Private James William Mainwaring, fought for Canada, much like your great uncle, Fred Wood. He lied about his age to enlist and to get into the fight. He kept a diary throughout the Great War. My wife has this. She's transcribed it. My wife's a genealogist. If you go there to historyauthor.com, you see some of the things she does in addition to being a musician and a computer person and an author in her own right. She's traced her family tree back incredibly before the time of Jesus, literally. One of the real historical figures she has in her family tree is her grandfather, who she was fortunate enough to know. It just sounds like he was an amazing character. He finally goes to the doctor sometime in the 80s, and the doctor says, "When were you last at the doctor?" And he says, "Oh, I guess my physical for the war." And the doctor asks him, "You mean Korea?" He says, "No." "World War II?" "No, the Great War." So it's just a healthy man. He's some amazing stories about the war. But this idea of the food, this again and again in his diary, he has a single entry of two words and he writes, "bad grub." One of the little things that came down to Kathy through her mother was he never wanted to eat tomatoes. And they never knew why. They just thought it was a personal taste. Then we were in London. We went and saw War Horse. And we picked up another brochure for another film. And there were the cans on the set of tomatoes over and over. And it clicked in my head that when we studied about sheep production, my degree being in animal science, they talked about how much mutton there was. There are more sheep than people in Australia during the world wars. And then right after the production plummeted, these men came home and said, "I never want to see another piece of mutton again," because they just had been sick of it, eating it every day. And so how did this food and how did the home life come across in these letters? What impact did the rationing and the terrible food for folks like James Mainwaring and your great uncle, Fred Wood, how did it affect them and the people at home?
Well, you're absolutely right. Food was a very important for the soldiers at the front. People don't believe me when they say, "What is this thing that the soldiers from the front write home about most often?" When I say food and weather, they often don't believe me. But it's absolutely true, because food and weather was what governed their lives apart from the enemy. Well, at the front, it wasn't exactly that food was short. In fact, I noticed this in a photograph of my own grandfather, and other people have said it too. Very often the photographs taken at the front show them really quite plump. They got enough food, but it was just extremely boring. As you say, mutton, 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 mutton. And from a British point of view, bully beef and biscuits, bully beef and biscuits, bully beef and biscuits. And the biscuits were rock hard. And any time there was an opportunity to have something a little bit different to eat, it raised spirits. So people, men, when they got food parcels, they were over the moon. And perhaps I could read you an extract from a soldier called Tom Fake, who wrote assiduously to his wife throughout the war. 2 years' worth of letters from the Western Front were passed on to me by Tom Fake's great niece. And he's a real character, a lovely, modest man, but quite finickety when it comes to the particulars in life. And when his wife sent him a food parcel and half the food inside it had just been crushed, he really was quite irritable about it. And this is what he wrote back to his wife. And I think his irritability reflects how important food was to the men in the trenches. He said, "I opened the parcel dinner time today to find the cake and biscuits a lot of crumbs. When I sat down to write this, I intended not to let you know, but I've thought since I might as well, or perhaps you might be tempted to send another. Now, my dear, don't send any more. It is a waste of time and money to do so. You might as well have the benefit of it yourself. The chocolate was also crushed, and the French nougat was like some sausages that had been stepped on. Lucky wife, the bread and butter was all right, also the two cigars. Now, my dear, don't get grieving over this, but try and persuade yourself that it is no use sending them. Oh, I forgot to mention that the candles were all right." And another time, when they really went to town describing in letters home the food that they had, was at Christmas, which was always celebrated as best as they possibly could. And the people at home sent lovely food parcels, and the sort of army cooks did their best to source food locally. And letter after letter written at Christmas times lists the menu, and you can almost hear the men salivating as they're writing it. It was a little bit different at home, the food situation, because of the shortages. Obviously, there was a blockade. The Germans were blockading merchant vessels, so food supply was short, not half as short as it was in Germany, by the way, where there was mass starvation. But there were shortages at home, and towards the end of the war in Britain, there was rationing. And it made life even more difficult. People still had enough to eat, but having to queue up for hours if you had young children outside shops made life even more miserable than it was already. That's what I would say about the food difficulties at home.
I think it's worth noting, as you talk here about writing letters back and forth to spouses, that this isn't a book just of soldier letters, even though it's called Letters from the Trenches, of course. There are plenty of views of women. There's a lot of longing, of course. There's trouble that they're facing with rationing, and they're raising children on their own. There were four sisters whose diary entries, they're among my favorite parts of Letters from the Trenches. So introduce us briefly to Kitty, Sylvia, Madge, and Rosie.
Yes, they were the Sneed-Kinnersley sisters, and they lived with their widowed mother in Weymouth, which is a town on the south coast of England. They were educated girls, they were independent-minded, they were humorous, they were irreverent, and they kept diaries throughout their lives. They were actually the grandmother and great aunts of my husband. And when at his family home I discovered these diaries, I could not believe my luck. Madge, particularly, was very honest in what she wrote. All the sisters began the war as Red Cross nurses. We picture Red Cross nurses perhaps like, oh, submissive and serious-minded, willing always just to do their best. But the Sneed-Kinnersleys weren't altogether like this, as some extracts from Madge's diary show. She had to do what she was told by professional nurses, which didn't always go down very well. And sometimes also she couldn't hide her squeamishness at some of the more unsavoury tasks she was asked to perform. She wrote, "Went round with a nurse who did dressings. I put bandages on. One awful one on groin, brackets, disgusting, did it badly. Then a few days later, in ground floor ward, washed hands and faces, rubbed backs." And she was also honest enough to admit when her nursing skills weren't up to scratch. "Nearly killed a man with painting him with iodine. Too strong. Ugh. Skin peels." And one wonders, these poor soldiers having faced near death in the trenches, coming back to these rather unskilled nurses. I suppose at least they had pretty smiles. And one thing that the Sneed-Kinnersleys were good at doing was cheering up the patients. They were very sociable. And Madge wrote, at the beginning of the war, when a lot of Belgian wounded came in into her hospital, she said, "One could talk a little English, but I jabbered French to them. All from Antwerp and war, rheumatic with lying in trenches. 95 altogether, about 25 in my ward. Gave them tea and supper, weak coffee. They said I was bien gentil and j'aime mademoiselle Madge. But apparently not everyone approved, and the nursing sisters, she said, sisters nasty, asked me not to talk to men. So it was a sign of the times, although by the end of the war, women were talking to men much more freely.
Yeah, it really changed so many of those things. You mentioned that as well in the book about how courtship was very different. And then to write the letters, you wouldn't be gushing your feelings. Of course, today people not only gush between lovers, but they post everything on social media. There's much less reserved than they were then. But you were talking about the nurse and about her putting the iodine on. Can you imagine that poor soldier going out there? I mentioned my wife's grandfather, James Mainwaring. He had no hair on his legs, I believe, because he suffered one of the chemical attacks.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a scar that he held. So when if somebody asked him, there's a story. You know, of course, the Hun gassed me. But can you imagine this fellow walking around the hospital burned by iodine, and they said, oh gosh, what was it? Was it a flamethrower? Was it the Germans? What was it, a bomb went off? And he says, no, it was a nurse that burned me this way, and I'm hoping to recover quickly. I mean, I imagine the soldiers, fellow soldiers, would have given him quite a ribbing over that, the poor fellow. So hope he came through that okay.
I'm sure they were all suffering their own forms of wounds as far as Madge, if they were nursed by Madge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do, too. Obviously, medical science was not very advanced back then in the best of care. So, and so many wounded, not to make light of it. It's so many people there suffering that I guess you have to keep your sense of humor. Maybe a popular culture reference that people will know, especially our British listeners. Mm-hmm. There's that famous poignant scene that concludes Blackadder Goes Forth, the fourth series.
Yeah.
Everyone goes up over the top, and it's iconic, of course. And I know since I first watched it, I've gone back to it over the years just to watch that episode, how they mix the humor there. And then that poignant moment where it dissolves and goes into the poppy fields. If people haven't seen it here in the U.S., I would urge you to just go out there and check on YouTube and view that final episode over the top. And so although it's a comedy series, because it's so popular and so iconic, I wonder how your view of it might have changed.
Well, I think it's very easy, unless you've studied in depth, to see the First World War through, and I'm not the first person to have said this, through the eyes of the war poets, to see innocents led to their deaths by incompetent generals, and to see the war just being one line of trenches on the Western Front. But since I've done all my research, my view has broadened inevitably. First of all, it wasn't, of course, all on the Western Front in France and Belgium. There were many lesser-known theatres of war, Mesopotamia being one of them, and modern-day Iraq, Gallipoli, Italy, as we've mentioned after the war, northern Russia. It was also about more than just fighting, because when men were at the front, they spent very little time actually fighting. They spent their time clearing trenches, mending trenches, laying barbed wire, standing on sentry, going to rest areas but not being rested because they had to take supplies up to the front. There was a lot more involved. It wasn't just these scenes of men flying over the top. There's also, I think, an impression that it was a lot of wasteful charges, wasting young lives, and it was all wrong. But of course, at the time, there was no choice. The Allies were faced with an aggressor, and if Britain had decided to stay out of the war, they could have had that aggressor lapping at their own shores. So unlike today's conflicts, I think it's a little bit more clear. There was, as far as the Allies were concerned, a clear enemy, and something had to be done to stop that enemy getting its way. So to answer your question, I suppose I see it as a lot more complicated than just the scene in Blackadder would suggest.
It wasn't all just a war to move poor General Haig's liquor cabinet, as I think they say at one place, a few more inches. But I'm sure these were the kind of jokes, though, that they were telling at the time. And just that snapshot there to see a whole generation vanish really is a tough part. And it's good that they didn't just vanish, the ones that left letters behind that are included in your book. And that brings us to the section you have at the end of the book called Lest We Forget. Describe that tribute, what it is, and why you included it.
Well, it's just in my own small little way, I wanted to pay tribute to all the men and the women and the children whose letters I've used in the book, or I didn't use, whose letters I read during my research. And I listed every one of them, along with the family member who got in touch with me to say, look, here's something you can use. Because I didn't want these people from 100 years ago just to be distant figures who were involved in a distant war. They were living, breathing people like us, part of families that are still living and breathing today. And that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want them ever to become part of history. But they are part of history, I know. But we must remember that they were real people and not just historical figures.
As we come to our last question, that's a great way to wrap it up. How, as we're at this centennial of the Great War, how do you think people can remember soldiers like this, James Mainwaring, Charlie Butler, of course, Fred and Edwin Wood, Sid, the children left behind, the wives who were on the home front? How do you think people listening can help remember the Great War and the people who endured it?
Well, I think if we're just honest and we record and we remember all those who went through it truthfully, and by that, I suppose, I mean we remember them as ordinary people because that's all they were, living their lives. We see the war as some horror film, sort of revealing before us. But as you said earlier, to them, it was their life. It was a very difficult life. They didn't know what was going to happen, but they just got on with it. They did what they had to do and they lived their lives as best they could. And that's how I would like to remember them, rather than us, possibly a bit self-indulgently sometimes, building all this sort of grief and celebration into it. Let's just remember these for the ordinary people they were, doing the best they could.
Jacqueline Wadsworth, thank you so much for sharing Letters from the Trenches with us, letting us hear from this Great War generation. It really is a wonderful book, which I paused because it sounds like a strange thing to say, but that's how you wove this tale. It's really a human story. It is not just stories of men and horses being blown apart here. This is a story with love and humor. And if you want to get an idea of what it was like in the war on all the many fronts, please pick it up and do your part to remember them.
Thank you very much indeed, Dean.
Again, the book is Letters from the Trenches, The First World War by Those Who Were There. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase the book at our website, historyauthor.com, and we hope you will click through there. We get a tin of bully beef and some of those rock-hard biscuits every time you do. Once again, thank you to Jacqueline Wadsworth for joining me. She had to call all the way from Bristol, England, across the Atlantic Ocean to get in touch with me, which still sounds pretty impressive, even in the year 2015. She shared these voices of the Great War so that we can all remember them. Please visit soldierletters.blogspot.com. Again, notice soldier, singular. And follow Soldiers Letters, plural, on Twitter. We hope you'll let us know what you think of the book and the interview on Twitter at HistoryDean or Facebook.com/HistoryAuthor. And if you're interested in learning about the soldiers and civilians in your family tree, I'm going to plug the Family History Research tab at historyauthor.com. That'll put you in touch with my wife, Kathy, who loves to connect people with the branches, twigs, and leaves in their family tree. And if you have an interesting story you'd like to share after her research, maybe we'll feature you here on the show. There are some amazing tales out there that she's uncovered for the people she's done research for. Who knows? You might be related to one of the veterans of the Great War in Jacqueline Wadsworth's Letter from the Trenches. Like the show says, who do you think you are? Well, that's it for this week's installment of the History Author Show. I hope you'll join us next week for another trip into the past here on iHeartRadio or wherever you're listening. And as this is our Veterans Day episode, I want to take a moment to remember all of those who came before. It's easy to make these sound trite, but I am sincere in saying for everybody here at the History Author Show, we thank you for your service. I hope you'll join us next time for another trip into the past here on iHeartRadio or wherever it is you're listening. And remember, if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please take a moment to leave us a review. Well, until next Monday morning, thank you, Jacqueline. Thank you very much to all our veterans. Thank you to everybody who sacrifices on the home front. And happy reading.
And then came the day Broadway wasn't prepared, when the newsboys yelled extra, war is declared. But the hand that held glasses of wine in the air were the first to hold guns when I rode over there. The boys won the war and came home from the fight. The last night on Broadway was almost his night. But ever since then, it's a different street. Gone are the places where the gang used to meet. We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.